On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
Here's Dennis Irwin to take it. It's come straight out to McLaughlin. It's there. Alan McLaughlin has done it. He could not believe it. He looked for the linesman's flag, but Windsor Park is stunned into silence. Alan McLaughlin has struck gold for Ireland. His very first goal for the Republic of Ireland, headed out by Taggart. He seized the responsibility, and the man from Portsmouth proves himself another masterstroke as a substitution.
Now, you hardly need that piece of commentary explained to you, but if you don't remember it or you can't place it, that is the goal that sent the Republic of Ireland to the World Cup in USA in 1994, scored on the 17th of November 1993 by Alan McLaughlin, whose death was unfortunately confirmed this week. This was in November 1993, and it was in a fairly fraught international fixture against Northern Ireland in Windsor Park, and it was a fairly fraught time. The IRA ceasefire was just around the corner, although most people couldn't possibly have known it. And it had already been a brutal year in the north. There had been some of the worst atrocities of the entire Troubles, including the Greysteel massacre in Derry. Northern Ireland, put it this way, was very much at the top of the international news agenda. And in that kind of atmosphere, maybe the last thing that Ireland needed was a World Cup qualifier between the two jurisdictions and the two footballing representatives. And lo and behold, that's exactly what we got. And although the name of Alan McLaughlin will forever be synonymous with that goal in Windsor Park, the game even happening there was in doubt, as Donal Fallon joins us now to tell us. Donal, good afternoon. Hope you're keeping well. The great hope of football is probably an old cliche, but it's never really applied here, is it?
No. And, you know, a lot has been written internationally on the great unifying power of football. You know, a game so significant to our lives. You know, it could literally bring men out of the trenches together in the First World War. And there's all the old cliches about football, you know, that it takes kids from the favelas and it turns them into international stars. You know, football equals hope. Mm. But any of that kind of great unifying power of football, unfortunately, has never really made its presence felt in Ireland. And it seems, sadly for us, historically, football, rather than being an escape from politics, it's always been like an instrument of politics. Yeah. You know, and so it was with poor Belfast Celtic, who were, you know, driven from the Northern League and actually driven out of existence by sectarianism. Mm-hmm. Derry City, who had to play in the Southern League. The absolutely horrific violence that marred the Dundalk Linfield games. I mean, people that were there will never forget those games. Mm. And of course, right up to Lansdowne Road in 1995. Yes. I think we can all agree that kind of none of those events do happy football stories make. But probably the night when politics and football met most head on was November 1993, when this very, very curious thing happened. And hearing that clip, it's just so incredible, so emotional.
What's remarkable about the clip, actually, I think, is that George Hamilton, ironically enough, you know, a man of Belfast stock, you know, so excited about describing the goal, and but also talking about how Windsor Park had fallen into silence because there were no travelling fans there.
Yeah, he must have been the only person really standing up and cheering, which is an extraordinary part of that clip. But, you know, Jack Charlton's team, which had built an incredibly loyal following, I mean, they had literally raided the savings accounts, the credit unions of Ireland to get to Italian 1990. I mean, there wasn't a fiver in the country, and yet they made it to Italian 1990 in such numbers. Suddenly, this incredible travelling support are totally absent from the stands for the first time, you know, a mere 100 miles up the road from Dublin. So it's a really strange story in terms of what's happening off and around the pitch rather than what's happening on it.
Mm. And much focus this week, of course, has rightly been on Alan McLaughlin, who died in such a tragic and untimely way. But there's other people who were entangled in this story, and some of them very directly so.
Absolutely. And kind of more forgotten names in Irish footballing history. Alan Kernahan, who's a player who actually lines up for the Republic that day, but who'd represented Northern Ireland at schoolboy level. He'd been a Windsor Park ball boy. I mean, imagine what this must have been like for him. And every touch of the ball from him was kind of viciously booed and jeered. And then we can't forget Jack Charlton, a British sporting hero, you know, someone who embodies the greatest moment in British sporting history, who finds himself in an environment unlike anything he'd really ever encountered before.
Yeah, curiously, in slightly earlier times, and this is probably something which to more younger listeners will probably come as a bit of a shock, there had been enormous interest, but also, you know, whether it was supportive or not, very begrudging support for the team of Northern Ireland among footballing watchers in the South.
Absolutely. I mean, throughout the 80s, the conflict in Ulster is really at its height, but the Northern Irish football team did something that to many people in the South, or at least south of Newry, seemed totally impossible to us. You know, they qualified for major tournaments. Mm. They represented the island of Ireland in their own way, whether they wanted to or not, on the world stage. And Jack Anderson, the sports writer, he writes about this really beautifully about the 80s. He says, for those of us now in our mid-40s and from the South, the Northern Ireland football team that qualified for the World Cups of 82 and 86 provided the only international football glamour of the decade. We cheered for them, we liked them, and in our childish naivety, we wondered if under Billy Bingham's canny management, we could unite them with our own talented but underachieving team of Lawrenson, Whelan and Brady. So I think a lot of people in the south of Ireland, they watched the North in the World Cup in the 80s. You know, the volume on the TV sets might have been down during the national anthems. Mm. But at the end of the day, these were, you know, young Irish lads on the world stage. And Roddy Doyle, with typical humour, he talks about it. I watched Northern Ireland milling everything around them in the World Cup in Spain. I cheered them and I hated them. But I think we liked them at a comfortable distance.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, the idea of actually having to compete against them for qualification to a major event was really, really far from ideal.
The one thing, again, worth highlighting for people who aren't necessarily avid football watchers, when you talk about Northern Ireland qualifying for World Cups in 1982 and 1986, those were World Cups in which only 16 teams were participant. So, like, you really had to be the creme de la creme to have made it. A little bit like the Republic making it to Euro 88. There were only 8 teams participating. So, like, it was remarkable to have made the cut for that. So then fast forward then to 1993 and this idea that, you know, people who had grown up watching and begrudging the achievements of Northern Ireland, we're now looking at their own team as the great white hope.
Yeah, and the great humour of Northern Ireland fans is that, you know, they chant, "We're not Brazil, we're Northern Ireland." You know,
yes.
acknowledging
easy mistake to make, in fairness, yeah.
But the glory days are gone. I mean, they have a mural to a 1-0 victory over England in a friendly match still up in East Belfast. I mean, the great days of Northern Irish soccer have passed probably. But by 93, the football winds are already blowing in a very different direction. And I mean, the Republic are now World Cup veterans, the European Championship veterans, and they smashed the North 3-0 in the first qualifier of the campaign between the sides. And Paddy Bonner writes about that in his autobiography. He calls it the destruction of Northern Ireland. I think the roots of a lot of the anger in Windsor Park later are in that match in Lansdowne, because the crowd are chanting, you know, confident and cocky, "There's only one team in Ireland, one team in Ireland." So if the North could, you know, later on proved to be a spanner in the works for the Republic's qualification, you can bet that was something that they were going to relish. And there's certain things about the Republic of Ireland team in 93 that, you know, we don't really think about anymore. We kind of forget these things now. But in the early 90s, they're very fresh memories. This is a team who had gone to Italy to compete in the World Cup and enjoyed an audience with Pope John Paul II. You know, this is the Pope's 11, as far as some people are concerned.
Yeah, and so the first visit back to Windsor Park after that was never going to be too hospitable in that light, really, was it?
Absolutely. And players like Niall Quinn talk about this in their memories, that people are shouting at these Irish players, many of whom are not mass-going Catholics at all, about the Pope, you know, and about meeting the Pope. And then there's other things that kind of annoy certain sections of the Loyalist press. I mean, it's a team that has an open-door policy as far as Irishness is concerned. It recruits from the diaspora. Jack Charlton really beautifully defended that. He always said that if the course of Irish history was different, many of these young men would have been born on the island of Ireland. Now, I don't think that was always true, because some of them, when you look at them, they're the products of relationships between different migrant groups in Britain and the melting pot that was British life. But I think the willingness of the Irish team to look at Salford, Liverpool, Birmingham, not just kind of Galway, Cork and Dublin for talent, that's a defining feature of the team and the time, but it's something that, you know, it's not particularly light north of the border.
Go backwards a few minutes and tell us about Alan Kernahan, who you mentioned once upon a time had been a ball boy in Windsor Park and was now there wearing opposition colours.
Such a strange story, Alan Kernahan. English born, moves to the north as a kid, plays at schoolboy level. One of his caps actually against the Republic. And he's really more than happy. He's quite proud and willing to compete for the north. He says, "I played for Northern Ireland schoolboys and I'd always hoped to take the next step and go on and play for the senior team. But the Irish Football Association, not to be confused with the FAI, the IFA in Belfast, found that I wasn't eligible. It was a shock. I spoke to the IFI to try to find some way forward, but they just said no." So that's exactly the kind of player that Jack would welcome into the Republic's fold. He's able to play at an international level. And if you don't want him, or if you won't have him, we'll take him. And he goes into Windsor Park as this kind of hate figure. You know, he's denounced in the press in the days up to the match as a Lundy. This is incredible term. Yeah,
you need to explain that one for us.
Colonel Robert Lundy, his effigy is still actually burned on some 12th of July bonfires by more kind of historically conscious loyalists. He was a governor of Derry who called for the surrender of the town in 1688. That's where "No Surrender," the loyalist slogan, comes from.
Okay.
And Lundy basically means traitor. I mean, a Lundy is a kind of rotten Protestant, if you will. So there's a ridiculous level of hostility to this young man. who had willingly and proudly represented the North, who wanted to go on and play for Northern Ireland, but who was told he couldn't and instead was wearing the white jersey, as it was on the night of the Republic. But he's subjected to real 90 minutes of real serious abuse.
Put the fixture itself in November 1993 in a bit of wider context for us, because the weeks that were going on before the game were incredibly violent, and yet behind the scenes there were also some secret moves to bring a lasting peace as well.
Yeah, history has kind of revealed what people at the time didn't know now, that there was a lot going on behind the scenes as far as secret peace talks were concerned. London was finally willing to talk to Republicans. This was the major years. You know, Thatcher was a distant memory. President Mary Robinson had gone to Belfast that year. She shook the hand of Gerry Adams, which was a big, big moment. Mm. John Hume is really at the height of his powers, opening kind of doors of dialogue. There's a lot going on towards the peace process, not all of it very visible to the public. But then there's horrible things happening. I mean, there's Grace Steele weeks before the match, civilians fired in a pub by the UDA. The horror of the Shankill Road bombing not long before that, one of the worst atrocities of the Troubles. And there's just a lot of innocent blood, you know, Catholic and Protestant, shed in the weeks kind of leading up to this match. And actually, the UFF and the UDA in particular are just out of control at that moment in time. So the big question is, what do we do here? And the idea is put forward by international footballing bodies that the game be played in a neutral venue on the neighbouring island behind closed doors. But in fairness to the IFA, some people in there insist we can't do that. That's the wrong approach. It's deeply defeatist. Mm. It sends the wrong message about the North.
It is in a funny way. It's a kind of a surrender, to borrow the phrase.
Absolutely. And they've had to do it in the 70s. I mean, England, Northern Ireland were playing home games in England at a point in the 70s, which is ridiculous. So you get in about 11,000 people going to the game. They give 400 tickets to the FAI. But the FAI essentially advises supporters not to go. And there would have been a sizable kind of northern contingent to the Republic support.
Yes. Yeah.
And they tell people not to go. And nearly everyone doesn't. Definitely, there's more than four fans of the Republic at the game. One of them, a guy called Gary Spain, talked about his recollections of being there a bit over the years. Mm. But the number, I would say, it's more than four, and it's less than 20 as far as, you know, fans of the Republic in Windsor Park is concerned. And most of them are sitting there in total silence, bar Gary, who jumps up to celebrate the goal.
Yeah, well, bar Gary and George Hamilton, because as you could hear in the commentary at the start, it was a fairly quiet Windsor Park when the goal did go in. The Northern Irish manager at the time, the aforementioned Billy Bingham, who we knew was about to step down, maybe didn't help to calm proceedings before kickoff.
No, and one of the great things about Jack Charlton that I think really came across in the recent documentary, which was so moving, is that Jack's language was always very inclusive. I think he was aware, as an English World Cup winner, managing this Irish team packed with diaspora blood, the complexities of identity, you know, Jack got all of that. Sadly, Billy, his Northern counterpart, who's a footballing legend for what he did for Northern Ireland, he just did not cover himself in glory coming up to this game. And he describes the Southern team as, quote, a bunch of mercenaries, happy to be picked because they couldn't find the way of making it with England or Scotland. I take a totally cynical view of the whole business. I am not prepared to skirt the issue, the same as I'm happy to state it's our intention to go out and stuff the Republic. And Billy just whips the crowd into a... I mean, there's footage of him on the pitch before the match, whipping the crowd into a total frenzy. It was his last game in charge of the North. So he let himself down, I think, somewhat on that occasion. But I think it was probably the humiliation of the 3-0 defeat in Dublin and the crowd chanting, there's only one team in Ireland, that probably inspired him. But when you read the accounts of the Irish players, I mean, Niall Quinn talks about hearing people shout trick or treat. That was shouted during the Grace Steele massacre because that happened at Halloween.
Oh, right.
The word Fenian, which, you know, to some Irish players who've been born in England, second generation, third generation players, they'd never really heard that term before. You know, there's people shouting at you as you run up the wings, you're a Fenian. So this is a very small minority of the North's support, of course. Most people who go along are good, decent footballing people who just want to watch a game of football. But that minority on that night, they're not successfully isolated. And I think because there's no away fans either, their presence in the ground is amplified, if you will. And definitely Niall Quinn and others, the way they talk about it, it wasn't a nice night to kick a football for a living.
Yeah, I always remember Niall Quinn talking about getting the bus on the way to the game and seeing a row of teenagers that were along the bus route. And they had this kind of coordinated choreography where a line of them were standing there perfectly still and would then all make out as if they were firing rifles at the team bus. And then they would all fall to the ground. And another row of teenagers standing behind them would then stand forward and fire their own mock round of rifle shot. And these were kids who, in Niall Quinn's eyes, could only have been 11 or 12 years old. And to be playing in that kind of hostility, I can't imagine what it was like. It was one of Niall Quinn's namesakes, though, who was one of the star performers on the night for Northern Ireland, because their performance, really forgotten in the midst of time, was very, very good on the night.
Yeah, absolutely. And the North deserve, when you strip away the politics and the context of the game off the pitch, I mean, Northern Ireland went out there and they played brilliantly. They fought for every ball. And then Jimmy Quinn, when he gets the goal in 71 minutes, the place is just sent into total delirium. And Ray Houghton's recollection of that moment is great. He says, you see the reaction of the Northern Ireland players. You think they'd won the World Cup. Mm. That was how much they wanted to beat us that night. It was a great goal. He gave Packie no chance. It just floated over him and into the net. And he talks about how at that moment, panic really set in for the Irish team. But the euphoria of Northern Ireland scoring that goal. And, had we not got one back, I think Jimmy Quinn would have, several murals in Belfast today.
The story of the night, though, as it tends to do, history being written by the winners, or at least by the equalisers, belongs to Alan McLaughlin.
Yeah, well, Ireland, we won many games and draws. That was the Charlton years.
And we still do these days, yeah.
Ireland win one all, but it was just an incredible moment in time. And I think given Billy's abuse of the diaspora nature of the Republic side, it was almost poetic that, a man who did it was a proud Mancunian. On 77 minutes, so you had this 6 minutes of just a cauldron of euphoria, and then Alan just silences the place. And the words of the economist David McWilliams on that goal, absolutely brilliant, from the Generation Game. I dug the book out, actually, just to find these words during the week. He said, when Alan McLaughlin's drive saved us at Windsor Park in a night of sectarian madness, we didn't ask whether his Manchester accent made him any less one of us than Gary Kelly, Packy Bonner or Roy Keane himself. Mm-hmm. McWilliams just bang on the money. But it was poetic that it would be a Manc who did it on the night.
Yeah. By the way, is a Manc born and bred? When he's introduced in that piece of commentary at the start, he's being introduced as a man from Portsmouth. He was playing for Portsmouth AFC at the time, but he was a Manc. We think about the players, Donal, I think in summary, as kind of diaspora, but I think the success of the team probably meant as much to the diaspora as well as to the home island.
I think that's the last great study that remains to be written on the Jack Charlton years for some historian or sociologist, the way in which the diaspora actually started following the team. And when you look at pictures of the Irish fans away in USA 94, Italia 90, you see the banners, Kilburn, Salford, Liverpool, they were all there. Mm. And I think without Alan McLaughlin, we never would have experienced one of the defining moments of our 20th century. I think my own earliest memories actually are the painted curbstones, the green, white and orange curbstones in Ballyfermot, and the great hope of 1994. And we really needed that as a people. And yeah, that World Cup journey, it was watched with a kind of enthusiasm and hope in the Irish centres of Kilburn, Salford, Birmingham, and English cities, which had sometimes been scarred by the conflict too. Places like Birmingham, which suffered much. Mm-hmm. Jack Charlton's team presented a kind of Irishness that, diaspora felt they could belong to, they could celebrate. And it was all about the best of both islands, what Jack gave us. And none of that could have happened. None of that euphoria could have happened without Alan McLaughlin. So, yeah, we owe him so much. And just so tragically young. I couldn't believe it when I heard the news.
Yeah, absolutely tragic. And I think one of the last games that the Republic had played in the last international window, they had a picture of him on the front because they knew that he was battling illness and they just wanted to send his good wishes. And there was an illustration of him celebrating that goal in Windsor Park in 1993. And I think it's an image that anyone who saw it live or anyone who saw it on TV or anyone who's seen it since, it's something that will very much live in their memories forever. Donald, we will let you go. Thank you, as always, for joining us. We might see you back in studio in person next week because what a time to be alive. So you might see you in the flesh in the meantime, but until then, thank you as always. Donald Fallon, historian, author of the Come Here To Me books and presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast on Dublin history, which you'll find anywhere you like online.
On the Record with Gavin Riley
on News Talk